From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the Texas water crisis. Parts of the state are running out of water. Is there a solution?
Yeah, the state water plan shows severe shortages in the later decades, in 2040, 2050, 2060, all across the state of Texas.
And has Texas hijacked the American agenda? That's what author Gail Collins writes in her new book.
The savings and loan crisis, the bank deregulation, No Child Left Behind, energy, the environment, so on. And I thought, wow, it seems to me that Texas has been setting the agenda.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. A broadcasting note for this holiday weekend, this is an archive edition of Texas Matters from June 22, 2012. For the first time since March of 2011, all of Texas is out of the worst stage of drought. The weekly U.S. Drought Monitor map shows none of Texas in exceptional drought. Weather officials say this spring has left most of the state in a position for lower temperatures and improved rainfall chances compared to last summer. But we're not out of the dry, wildfire-prone woods yet. In the current issue of Texas Monthly, the focus is the lack of water in the state, how it's impacting cities, industries, farmers, and ranchers. Nate Blakesley writes in Texas Monthly about the state's Water Development Board and its $50 billion proposal on how to deal with the water shortage.
Well, we've just come off the 2011 drought, which, of course, was the worst single-year drought in state history, and we've just had a new state water plan, a new edition of the state water plan published, and so water is sort of what's on everybody's mind and what everybody's thinking about, and certainly is one of the top public policy issues in Texas right now.
Is Texas Monthly trying to send out this klaxon alarm saying, you know, legislature, get serious about water next time you meet in Austin?
I think that's probably would be one of the takeaways for anybody that read the whole package that we ran. Of course, we're not trying to be alarmist. And one of the things that we do try to do in the piece is kind of put the current crisis in historical context. The 2011 certainly was the worst single-year drought that we've ever had. But it's not the worst drought in recorded history in Texas. That would be, of course, the 1950s drought of record. And so one of the things we tried to do with this package of stories is sort of take a look at how the state dealt with that drought in the 50s and sort of compare it to how we're dealing with the drought that we're undergoing today.
I hear this all the time about the drought of the 50s, and that seems to be like, okay, well, you know, it's not that bad as the 50s, but there's a lot of things that are a lot different now than there were in the 50s. The drought we had last summer was more intense than the drought of the 50s. And also, we have a lot more people in Texas now.
We definitely have a lot more people. And sort of the biggest takeaway from the 2011 version of the state water plan is the statement in the introduction, which warns that as dire as the situation seems right now, it will be much worse in later decades, because our population is projected to increase so quickly. We're projected to have 46 million people in the state of Texas by the year 2060, which is almost twice as many as we have today.
So we're waiting to see if the drought that we had last year is a watershed moment for Texas, if we're going to make some big changes in the way that we think about water.
Well, after the 1950s drought, we did change the way we dealt with water. That was when we first started statewide water planning, and that was when the state first started getting serious about investing in water infrastructure. Between 1950 and 1980, we built 126 new reservoirs. And you could argue that that 1950s drought really was a watershed moment in Texas. It was kind of a moment when Texas sort of was forced to leave behind that predominantly agricultural state that we all associated with Texas and become sort of a more modern urban state, or at least that's what the investment in the reservoirs allowed to happen. It allowed our cities to get much bigger, and it made us much more attractive to industries looking to relocate. And so the question now is, well, what will our response be to the 2011 drought? We obviously are faced with a series of major decisions about whether and how to make another round of major investment in water infrastructure. And what I reported in my piece is that it's far from clear whether we're going to do that. And if we do decide to make that investment, it's not clear that the state water plan we have today is necessarily the best guide to how best to use those limited resources.
There's this $53 billion package of proposals that the Texas Water Development Board is kicking around as some projects that could be solutions for Texas water in the future. Building new reservoirs, I mean, you can't hold back every drop of water that falls on Texas. I mean, we still have to have active flow going to the Gulf of Mexico.
Right. There are 26 new reservoirs proposed in the 2011 plan. If you talk to some of the planners, you know, sort of off the record, many of them will tell you they certainly don't expect to see 26 new reservoirs built. Some of them will say we may never see another major new reservoir built in the state of Texas. But there are many other plans that would increase water supply, many other projects that would increase water supply in the state water plan, new water treatment plants, expanded pipeline facilities, and sort of the most radical idea of all, moving some of the abundant water from East Texas, which is, after all, very sparsely populated but gets a great deal of rain, over to Central Texas, where about 40% of our population lives along that strip from I-35 that goes from San Antonio all the way up to Dallas-Fort Worth, where it doesn't rain very much, moving some of that water from east to west. One of the things that has been proposed for many years now and is also proposed again in the new version of the state water plan is to build pipelines from the Toledo Bend Reservoir, which is on the Sabine River in far east Texas. It's the largest man-made reservoir in the south. It is essentially unallocated. Most of the water in it is available because so few people live near it. Enough water spills over the dam of Toledo Bend every day to serve every household in Dallas-Fort Worth and Houston, too. The problem is that it's so far away from those places and it's so expensive to build a pipeline. And even if you had the money, the politics of moving water from East Texas to the urban parts of the state are tricky at best. For years, the attitude in East Texas has been, this is our resource, we need it for our future growth. You know, it has become sort of a country versus city people sort of dynamic. Water is a zero-sum game. You know, somebody is going to win and somebody is going to lose. And that's one of the things that the water plan doesn't really address, is sort of the politics of how we're going to move water around the state of Texas and how we're going to decide who ends up winning and who ends up losing that game.
Will there be parts of Texas, I mean, is there in the forecast, that will have a crisis of supply of water?
Most definitely. Yeah, the state water plan shows severe shortages in the later decades, in 2040, 2050, 2060, all across the state of Texas, chiefly because of our booming population. It assumes that less water will be used for agriculture in the panhandle simply because they're going to be running out of water in the panhandle. You know, most of the water that goes to farming there comes from the Ogallala Aquifer. Everybody knows that aquifer is being mined, which is to say more water is being taken out every year than is put in, and it's unsustainable. And then in other urban areas, the water plan flatly says Texas cannot continue to grow at its current rate unless major investments are made to develop new water sources.
Nate Blakesley is a writer for Texas Monthly. This month, the magazine focuses on the state's water crisis. To much of the rest of the country, Texas is a mystery, or at least misunderstood. New York Times columnist Gail Collins proves that in her book about the state and its political power. The book is called As Texas Goes, How the Lone Star State Hijacked the American Agenda.
You know, I started out getting interested in this question of Texas after the famous Rick Perry secession speech, which was not really a secession speech, which I understand, but I, as a member of the other 49 states, did not feel the love after it was over. But so I started thinking about Texas and how much power, it seems to me anyway, Texas has had when it comes to setting the national agenda over the last 30 years. And I sort of went through a whole mess of things in my mind. The savings and loan crisis, the bank deregulation, No Child Left Behind, energy, the environment, so on. And I thought, wow, it seems to me that Texas has been setting the agenda. Why are so many people in Texas ticked off about the federal government? And so I came to Texas, and I've written what is totally an outsider's view of Texas. I would never in a million years argue that this is a proper description of the subtleties of life in Texas, which I will leave to the many amazing writers that Texas already has. But it's an outsider's view of what powers Texas has, how they got them, and what it means to the rest of the country.
So you write in a book that Texas tried secession once, and it didn't work out so well.
Right.
But actually, Texas has seceded twice, and the first time it worked out pretty good, and the first time we seceded, it was from Mexico.
Texas spent, 9 years as an independent republic. I find it sort of unnerving, the amount of focus in Texas on that tiny little period. Vermont was an independent republic for 14 years. It really never comes up at all in Vermont. I find it very unnerving when you look at the floor of the state capitol and you see sort of the seal, the design of the vision of Texas they've got down there, and the independent republic seal is smack in the middle, this humongous vision, and then around it are the other tiny five flags, one of which is France for the 2 minutes there was a French colony in Texas, and one of which is the United States flag. The whole independence thing seems to me to be a wildly overblown part of Texas's vision of what it is, looking at it from an outsider.
Yeah, you're going to have problems with that. When you come to Texas, when your book tour, that's not going to go over too well. I mean, I agree with a lot of what you say in the book, okay? But I always considered, Texas to be the super state, that we have a lot of influence. But you use the phrase in the title of your book, how the Lone Star State hijacked the American agenda. Now, hijacking, that means we're doing something wrong or even illegal.
You're right. It should not be an illegal thought. I certainly wouldn't say Texas has been doing something illegal. I would say that Texas has taken the reins, taken the lead, and pushed us in directions that, in some ways have been good. I think, I write in the book about, George W. Bush's attempt to reform education in a way that particularly focused on the progress that poor and minority children made. And Texas was doing that before George W. Bush became president, and it was virtually the only state that was doing that. So I'm certainly not arguing that there is nothing that Texas has ever done to influence the nation that's been bad, but it's been a lot. And I have to tell you, when I go around to other states, some of them, like New York and California, say, well, wait a minute, aren't we the most important state? And I generally say, well, they're both really, really, really important, but right at this moment, this is Texas's moment. This is when Texas is, if anybody's got the reins, Texas has got the reins. And people in New York actually take that pretty well. People in California are somewhat dismayed at the entire idea that it's not California that's the leader right now, but I do think it's Texas's moment. I'm not sure anybody in Texas would disagree with me that Texas is the most important state in the union right now.
Well, okay, I'll disagree with you.
You want to give it to Vermont?
Well, I mean, the thing is, maybe 10 years ago, mm-hmm. Texas was the most important state in the country, where we had a president in the White House. It was 10 years ago that George W. Bush signed into law the No Child Left Behind. And we had a virtual Texan in the vice presidency, Dick Cheney. He was practically a Texan. He lived in Texas for many years and controlled, was the head of Halliburton while he was in Texas. And he had to change his voter registration back to Wyoming when he ran as vice president. But now, I mean, Texas, we're the loudest. And this is where we have crystallized the greatest opposition to President Obama's agenda. But this is yelling and screaming and tantrum throwing from the peanut gallery and not exactly hijacking or having control over the national agenda.
I think, for one thing, what I tried to do in the book, if I can give you a couple of other book thoughts anyhow, that to me the country has always been divided politically between the philosophy of the crowded places and the philosophy of the empty places. That goes back to Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton. And it's a genuine vision. The crowded place vision accepts and likes government, appreciates government, because people can see every day all the useful things that government does if you live in a crowded place, to keep order, to provide services, and so on. If you live in an empty place, there doesn't seem to be any point. But what I argued in the book is that right now, the philosophy of empty versus crowded tends to be more mental than actually physical for the first time. And I've seen people in my travels in really empty places that have a strong sense that they're part of this great beehive of interconnectivity. And I go to places like Florida and find people in 400-unit condos who feel very strongly that they are all by themselves and government is getting in the way. And I think Texas, the Tea Party, is very much an empty space kind of vision. If you're an empty space person, you don't want to make government more efficient. You want to sort of get rid of as much of it as possible. That's an empty space vision. And Texas, to me, has always been the leader and the crystallizer in that modern Tea Party sort of version of empty space philosophy. And that's partly because wherever you live in Texas, it sort of feels like you're in a pretty empty space, because if you drive for 5 minutes, you're someplace completely else.
Well, more people in Texas work in high tech than they work in agriculture these days.
The thing about Texas that's also so important is how huge it is. When you have 26 million people and you have the second highest birth rate in the country, you're producing 10% of the incoming future workforce of America. So one of the things I argue also is that that's not just an issue for Texas. How Texas does, how they integrate the growing Hispanic population into the power structure of the state, and how Texas educates this humongous group of young people that it's got coming up, is a critical question for the national economy, not just for the locals.
You talk a lot about the Alamo in your book. And
not a lot about that, but it does come up. Yeah.
It seems like you've used it as an anchor in your book. You kind of open with it and you close with it. You refer back to it frequently in the book as a thread. And that's as very important to the Texas psychological profile of sometimes the bunker mentality.
Victory or death, yeah.
Terrific heroism that was involved with the defenders of the Alamo. You ask some tough questions about, you know, Davy Crockett, which I think that historians pretty much have a consensus on, that he did die at the Alamo.
As I said in the book, one of my happiest memories of my trips through Texas was spending an entire dinner party listening to historians argue about whether he actually died at the Alamo or was taken prisoner and executed later. And I just found it absolutely fascinating. And I'm not going to take a side in that discussion at all. But I do think the interesting thing about the Alamo is how it creates among the people, and as far as I can tell, almost every kid in Texas has been there on a pilgrimage at one point or another. It does create this victory or death kind of mentality about taking outside stands, and just standing there no matter what happens for your principles, for your independence. And to me, the greatest example of how that works for better or for worse was Lyndon Johnson, who, when he became president, to I think the shock of people maybe who knew him before, got the Civil Rights Act through Congress, knowing it was going to transform the politics of his own state, knowing full well that the Democratic Party was going to lose power in the South because of it, but just going there because that was the thing to do, that was the right thing. He took his stand, and it was a very kind of Alamo moment. But I would argue, too, that going forward on the war in Vietnam, when I think he knew also that that was a totally losing proposition, was in the same spirit. So I'm sort of looking at that Alamo spirit as a plus or a minus, depending on where you tend to be going with it.
One thing about the Alamo and the Tea Party that you brought up earlier is that, you know, when they launched the Tea Party, they had a huge national, different parties across the country, and the big one was at the Alamo, you know, with Glenn Beck broadcasting live from Fox News, and Ted Nugent playing his guitar out there, and people came from all over the country to be there for the launch of the Tea Party, and it was right there at the Alamo, and it was quite the scene.
Yeah, it's the Alamo means so many things to so many people. It's fascinating. When I went down, I did not thought much about the Alamo, I must admit, till I got down there, and I went through it a few times. And my two really strong reactions were: A, what heroic people, and B, this doesn't sound like a good plan. Maybe they should have gotten out and gone to help Sam Houston. The whole victory or death thing seemed like a loss of life for no really great reason. And, of course, Mexican-Americans look at the Alamo and there certainly were Mexican-Americans on both sides of the fight. You know, they see it as a vision, I think, often of Mexicans versus Anglos that puts them in a bad light.
People outside of Texas, how are they receiving this book?
It's interesting. People outside of Texas often have not thought much about Texas. Surprisingly little about Texas, and it's sort of interesting to go and talk with them about it. Although one thing that I find disturbing is there is a tendency on the part of people in northern parts of the country to be very dismissive of Texas. And whenever that comes up, I try always to point out that if, for instance, the city of Newark was flooded by a hurricane, I'm not sure that New York City would have been as eager to accept 200,000 refugees as Houston was after Katrina. And I think that along with what the sort of outsized influence and the real challenge to the welfare of the country that comes if Texas does fall down on its obligations to educate and incorporate its new generation into the economy of the country, outside of all those things, I think it's not, people don't give Texas enough credit because they have this Dallas vision for its generosity and its hospitality.
Well, I mean, it seems that there may be some hostility coming from Eastern establishment about Texas.
Well, there's always that sense that Texas is this large place that's not understood. So hopefully we'll have more of a meeting of the minds as things come on. But I don't know that that Texas is in danger from the country. Texas seems to be doing very well. I'm not sure that even Texas appreciates how much influence it's had over the last 30 years over the agenda of the country. And one of the things I tried to figure out in the book was when you talk about states' rights, which is a very big call, a political call certainly in Texas, what that really means. I took Texas as an example. What things that Texas does really are just its own business. And what things that it does that it regards as just its own business actually slosh over the borders and have a big effect on the country as a whole.
There is this type of beer. It's called Texas Pride. And it's the worst beer you can possibly imagine. It's a near beer, which means it doesn't have it's like 2% alcohol. And
good for you.
And it's, it just tastes terrible. But anything that you slap the words Texas Pride on is you can sell a terrible product on with, and people will more likely accept it because I'm proud to be a Texan. And that's kind of the way it is with politics sometimes. You know, you can say, this is the way Texans do it. We don't need federal influence on telling you how to clean up our water. We like our water dirty. And so I'm wondering, you know, if that happens, if you think that happens, that this is a manipulation of the, you know, of people, sort of like a nationalism of Texas so that we can get the population to do things which really isn't in their best interest.
I think it's absolutely true that the politics of Texas involves a lot of people, and I would include the governor in this category, who get their political mojo out of attacking the federal government and spend much less time thinking about how to actually take care of the problems within Texas. One of the things I talked about in the book was Texas's policies on things like family planning, which would seem to be a local issue that Texas can do all by itself. It's all their business, except that 60% of the deliveries in Texas are delivered under Medicaid because the women are so poor. And as part of the taxpaying public that's paying half that bill federally, I'm really happy to give that support to Texas women who need it. But I'd like to know in return that Texas was making an effort to make sure that women who did not actually want to get pregnant had the resources to avoid getting pregnant. So that's the kind of thing that seems to me to be an issue that's not quite as much a state's right as you think. And the same thing certainly goes for anything having to do with the environment or global warming. I do think that Texas has had the leading role in turning global warming into a debate in which the big fight is about whether it exists or not, rather than how to fix it. You know, Texas has the largest greenhouse gas production in the country. And it's been, its politicians have been really, really active in trying to sort of discourage all discussion.
But Texas is leading the nation in wind energy production.
Yeah, if God made a place for wind to be produced for energy, it would look exactly like Texas. And it's in Texas's economic interest, certainly, and good for Texas to do that. But Texas has also been, you know, really, 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 really vigorous about stopping any attempts to control greenhouse gases. And which is the biggest problem right now.
And so when you talk about Texas, you seem to like you're using a really broad brush. And, you know, there's a lot of Texas and a lot of different Texans. I mean, there's Willie Nelson. You know, he's a Texan. And we're not all Rick Perry.
I know. I totally do understand that. And I hope I was at least good about pointing that out in the book. But I cannot say this is not a book about the subtleties of what it means to be Texas. That Texas is such a wide and varied country that I would...
Country.
I meant country as in a physical country, not as in a different country.
I thought
not
you had bought into
country.
That secession.
We could actually do this as a discussion. Texas, colon, not a different country. This country. But it's such a wide and varied place that it needs your own local people. I mean, the great Molly Ivins is the one that everybody brings up to me as a person, you know, who just wrote, you know, amazingly and brilliantly interpreting her state for the rest of the country. I am not Molly Ivins. I am a person who grew up in Ohio who is looking at it from the outside and trying to understand what it means to the rest of the country.
Well, I mean, for as Texans go, it's interesting to be talked about than to be better than being ignored, and it's nice to know what people are saying about you. And so is this what people are saying about Texas, is that we're, you know, hijacking the national agenda, that we're somehow controlling it and we're driving it, the national bus, into a ditch?
What I'm saying about Texas is that Texas has the choice about where the country is going right now, because it is so huge, because its Hispanic population is going to be so influential. It's driving the bus about the integration of the massive new Hispanic population in this country into, hopefully, the business, the political leadership of the country, into the economic upper classes of the country, the professional classes of the country. And if Texas screws that one up, we are indeed all going into a ditch.
Gail Collins is a columnist for the New York Times. Her new book is called As Texas Goes, How the Lone Star State Hijacked the American Agenda. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. There are past Texas Matters programs on our website at tpr.org. And you can subscribe to the free podcast on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.